Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We have a number of bills before us. Most of them are for work sessions. What we're going to do, though, is we're going to start off our public hearings, get those out of the way. The rule that we work here in the judiciary, if we have members that are appearing on a bill, we will take their testimony. We may close the testimony after they testify and bring other people up at a later time. Due to the workload that all of the members have, it's my prerogative and best use of their time to get them in and out as quick as we can. With that, we're going to start off with a hearing on House Bill 2897A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2897A requires the court to make findings by placement of a child with a relative is not in the best interest of a child. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senators, thank you very much for hearing House Bill 2897. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. Simple bill with good intentions. It requires the court to make written findings regarding preferences for and placement of child or ward with relatives where the judge in those few cases decides that contrary to the placement decisions of the Department of Human Services, placement of a relative is not in the best interest of a child. Mr. Chair and members, I serve as a House Representative on the State Commission for Children and Families and have a long history with the Commission for Children and Families. I've learned in a meeting a year or so ago how important it is to place children, foster children, with relatives and the success of this program. But let me tell you what brings this bill to you today. I have a friend who had custody of her granddaughter. She's had it for 13 years since the granddaughter was 20 months old. The granddaughter's daughter was addicted to drugs and gave custody to the grandmother. The daughter later had another child and then finally decided to give up this child. At the time, the grandmother was having some medical concerns and hesitated to take the other child until the medical issue was confirmed or went away. Thus, the department placed the second granddaughter with a guardian. Then when the grandmother discovered the medical concern was not serious, she petitioned to be guardian for the second granddaughter and raised the two sisters together. DHS on two occasions recommended placement with the grandmother and sibling. And after a sensitive issue adoption committee twice recommended placement with the grandmother, the judge, however, decided not to place the second granddaughter with the grandmother. The grandmother, after spending over $20,000 to win guardianship, gave up, but I think she would do an explanation. And this bill will not help my friend, but maybe will assure the courts take extra time to try to place children with relatives unless it's in the best interest of the child. I had great support in drafting this bill from Belisa Sidlick with the Legislative Council. I also had several meetings with Kevin George and Mickey Saris from DHS and Bruce Miller with the Justice Department. We had a meeting before the bill went to the House Committee with Judge Nan Waller, Nancy Cozine from the Judicial Department, and several others, including Legislative Council, to make sure we produce the bill for you today, Mr. Chair, that has no fiscal. So with that, I'll be glad to answer questions. Kevin George is here from the Department of Human Services to support the bill and to assure you that there's no fiscal. We found that there's maybe been three or five cases in the last few years where this has happened, where the department made a recommendation and the courts did not follow that recommendation for placing with relatives or filing. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I know you have a busy schedule, but I'll be glad to answer any questions if you have.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the representative? Senator Wisnett?
Thank you. Representative Wisnett, do the courts not currently make a written decision?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wisnett, it's not required.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? And I don't see anyone else that wanted to testify today on House Bill 2897A. Is there anyone? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on the work session on House Bill 2897A.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2897A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2897A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Wisnett, will you be our carrier on this? Get this right.
You'll do it.
The W for the W. All right.
Thank you.
All right. And we'll close that work session and...
2796. One down. Ready to go.
All right. Open the public hearing on 2796A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2796A prohibits setting aside a conviction for criminally negligent homicide. No amendment, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I've got four people who want to give testimony, and brevity is the preferred way to do this. Ann Pratt, Janet Lovelace, Travis Sewell, I guess it is Sewell. Sewell, it looks like. And Doug Harkarode. So if we can bring up a fourth chair. And as people are coming forward, if you have written testimony, I'm going to ask you not to read your testimony, just from give us a summation. We've got seven bills today that I need public hearings, and another 30 or so we're going to try to work.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. First off, I want to say thank you to the chair for hearing this bill and the other bills that I've worked on during this session. And I also want to say thank you to the committee for your hard work. I'm in favor of House Bill 2697. Criminally negligent homicide is the only criminal homicide that can be set aside or expunged. The victim was killed by another person. It was no doubt just as violent, and they are certainly just as dead. House Bill 2796 is very personal for me. My youngest son was killed in 1998 by a drunk driver. He was charged with manslaughter one, and it was dropped all the way down to criminally negligent homicide by the judge. The offender received 18 months for the crime, which I felt was a pitiful sentence for 50 to 60 years of my son's life. So when I learned that criminal negligent homicides were being expunged in our state on a regular basis, in our court system, my first response to a procedure that I find outrageous was, if you can erase an extremely deadly crime from my criminal's record, does it mean then I will get my son back? That it really didn't happen at all. My son is not dead, or does it mean he never really existed, or my son's life and death means nothing? And how do you expunge death? My son died on the pavement. How do you expunge that? History cannot be erased. It is impossible to describe the excruciating pain painful effect this offender has had on our family. Nothing has been the same or ever will be or has it as it should be. And we all still grieve. The pain returns often unexpectedly and with a vengeance. The empty chair cannot be escaped, erased, or expunged. It has totally changed the course of my life. It's driven me here for the last five sessions, legislative sessions, a place I never expected to be. In spite of all we've lost and had to fight for, we have never felt beaten by this offender. But if your crime were to be expunged, I would not only feel beaten by this offender, I would feel beaten by the state of Oregon. In addition, in 2007, we passed a bill, aggravated vehicular homicide, House Bill 2740, which raises the penalty of a person who commits a criminal homicide, any degree, while under the influence of intoxicants, and has previously been convicted of a criminal homicide. We cannot expunge a crime that needs to be tracked or counted. There is also a current case in Oregon. The offender was convicted of crim neg 24 years ago and is currently charged with aggravated vehicular homicide. If we allow these offenders to expunge their criminally negligent homicide convictions, we cannot be in compliance with the legislative intent of the aggravated vehicular homicide statute, and we also continue to re-victimize the victims. Death cannot be expunged, cast aside, or set aside. Please do not continue this practice of expunging criminally negligent homicide. This bill passed the House 59-0 and I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Janet. Chair Przanski, it's nice to see you again, and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Janet Lovelace. I live in Pleasant Hill, which is in the Eugene area. I'll make this very short. I am here because I do want to pass Bill 2796, just because it's a common sense thing to do. My daughter was killed in June of 2000. She was hit and left. The driver left the scene, eventually was convicted of crim neg homicide. That fact alone is injustice enough. He only served 18 months. But to further allow him the future opportunity of wiping the slate clean of my daughter's death is injustice to the umpteenth degree. This hidden benefit to me, I call it a hidden benefit for a convicted criminal, is a flaw in the criminal justice system that must be changed. Again, I want to thank you for hearing the bill and for allowing me to testify. Thank you.
Thank you. Travis?
Yeah, my name is Travis Sewell. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm a deputy district attorney for Multnomah County. I've been a district attorney there for about 14 years. For the last four and a half years, I've been the attorney primarily responsible in reviewing expunction applications or set-aside applications in our county. Last year alone, I reviewed 1,055 such motions and applications from people trying to set aside records. Of those 1,055, I found that 172 were not eligible to have their conviction set aside or their arrest set aside due to them not meeting the statutory criteria. So I am considered a regional authority in the application of the statute by both defense attorneys and prosecutors and judges as well. Before going into some specific cases that I'd like to bring to the committee's attention today, I would like to just briefly go over the legal history on why this bill is so needed and what the problem is with.
Travis, I need you to summarize, and the examples, I think we've heard two very real examples, so I don't think we need to hear any more examples, but what we want is just basically the legal perspective of why you think it's necessary. I think you have a very receptive committee here.
Okay. Well, the reason this is so legally needed is criminally negligent homicide is currently the most serious crime that is subject to set-aside. It is currently a Class B felony. Most crimes that are subject to set-aside are Class C felonies, misdemeanors, or violations. Also, it is currently classified on the SGL, the sentencing guidelines, as either an 8 or the 9. That is as or more serious than even most Measure 11 offenses. Also, from a legal standpoint, the way the statute is currently written, the only way that the state or victim could object to a set-aside is under subsection 11 of the statute. It is a very, very high threshold for the court to deny set-aside for this particular crime. They would have to find by clear and convincing evidence that the set-aside is not in the best interest of justice, and that opinion has to be done in writing by the court. Of note, when subsection 11 first came into effect in 1993, it essentially did have bipartisan support. OCDLA did recognize that criminally negligent homicide is the most serious type of offense that would be subject to set aside. I guess the only specific example I'd like to bring up, I have had three cases this year. I find one fairly powerful. I just have about 15 seconds to explain that.
It'll probably take me longer to tell you not to do it.
Okay. Well, in any event, just to close my remarks, Your Honor,
being a prosecutor, I know you always want to have the last say, but we will have that last say.
So just to end my testimony, I would say, draw Senate's attention to Article 1, Section 43 of the Oregon Constitution, in that constitutional provision passed in November 1999 of people of the state. Criminal justice system is required to give due dignity and respect to victims. The two individuals sitting to my left are constitutional victims of these, of the crimes that they've attested to, and I do not feel that due dignity and respect would be given to the next of kin of people that have been killed. So ODAA and our office is in favor of this bill.
All right, Travis, thank you very much for coming down and giving your testimony. Doug?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name for the record is Doug Harkle Road, a past retired district attorney from Lane County, and currently represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. The Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance supports House Bill 2796. Basically, the expungement statute is the bill that I approve. I'm in favor of expungement for lots of different crimes. We are not in favor of expunging real serious crimes. Frankly, criminally negligent homicide was made a Class B felony, which is not expungible. B felonies are not expungible, except we didn't fix this part, where it is for the old law. And so we just need to do this simple fix, and we'll be done.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 2796A? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing. Open the work session on 2796A.
Chair, move House Bill 2796A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2796A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. And the chair will carry this one. We'll close the public the work session on 2796A. And our next public hearing is going to be on House Bill 2358.
House Bill 2358 prohibits free samples of non-cigarette tobacco products, defines non-cigarette tobacco products, allows Department of Human Services to impose a civil penalty not to exceed $1,250 for each violation to be paid into the general fund. There is a -3 amendment, and that prohibits free samples to minors in areas accessible to minors. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and it's ready to move today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Why don't we go ahead and bring up two panels here. I've got enough people here. So Dr. Hedberg, Rachel Banks, Randy Harris will be our first three.
What's a sample page?
Are we going to show people? And who's going to start?
Sure.
Looks like we got show and tell as well.
Yes, you do.
We don't smoke.
Yeah. Thanks, but we're trying to cut back.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the interim state epidemiologist with the Department of Human Services. And I am here to testify on House Bill 2358, which would prohibit the distribution of free samples of non-cigarette tobacco products. In addition, I wanted to mention that the -3 amendments we would oppose. We believe that there should be no free samples of these non-cigarette tobacco products handed out to anyone, and I'll explain why in a second. Smokeless tobacco is harmful and can be deadly. There's 28 cancer-causing agents. It's linked to cancers of mouth, throat, stomach alone. In 2005, there were almost 400 Oregonians who died of mouth and throat cancer and 193 from stomach cancer alone. Distributing free tobacco samples is a deliberate method for recruiting new young tobacco. Most adult users become addicted to tobacco for life. Tobacco companies spent in 2005, over $250 million nationwide promoting smokeless tobacco products and over $28 million giving out free samples. And I did bring some examples of the free samples. These are not small. This is an example here of Snus, which is a smokeless tobacco product, and I will pass it around to the committee. And you can see there's three different flavors.
Yeah, I just need you to give testimony.
Oh, okay.
Walking around.
These are the cigarette products, but Free samples are distributed at family events, including rodeos and fairs, and an example of that is the Farm City Rodeo in Hermiston, Oregon. Free sampling also occurs in convenience stores. And in rural Oregon, where a lot of these smokeless tobacco is heavily marketed to young men, one in three 11th grade boys are regular users, which is three times the rate of young men in urban areas. The highest rates for adult smoking and use of smokeless tobacco are among those aged 25 to 34-year-olds, which means that recruiting new tobacco users really extends to young adults as well. Part of the reason I was handing out these is that tobacco companies are marketing new products that appeal to youth. There's a variety of flavors, as you can see, and mini cigars, for example, are heavily marketed to girls and women. Free sampling is also a centerpiece for a campaign. That's the Snus product, which is a smokeless tobacco product, test marketed in Portland. And one of the reasons it was done in Portland, there was a ban in Washington State against handing out these free products. And so in order to do test marketing in the Pacific Northwest, they chose Portland. The best solution for keeping these free products out of the hands of kids is to prohibit free samples entirely. If you give them a lot of kids who might be the ages of 17 or 18 who should not be using these would get free samples from adults. The Federal Centers for Disease Control found that banning sampling is the most effective way of keeping tobacco out of the hands from kids and getting them from starting to use tobacco. We have strong evidence that sampling bans do work. The city of Pendleton passed an ordinance banning the free distribution of these products, and since that time, at the Pendleton Roundup, there's much less advertising, and the tobacco companies are not marketing the Pendleton Roundup as a place to give out free samples. So in summary, we strongly support House Bill 2358, but oppose the amendment because even if the sampling ban extended, it's now under the age of 18, but extended from 18 to 21, it's still a way that young kids can get products from older friends, family members, and others. And the best way to prevent young adults from starting to smoke or use tobacco products is to ban sampling of them altogether. So, thank you for your time.
All right, who wants to go next?
Go. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Banks, and I'm policy coordinator for the Chronic Disease Prevention Program in Multnomah County Health Department. I run the Multnomah County's Tobacco Prevention and Education Program, which is fondly known as TPEP, and I provided a written testimony that has the overview of our goals, but I just want to highlight one today, which is to prevent the initiation of tobacco by youth. As mentioned, the Federal Centers for Disease Control find greater evidence and greater effectiveness of programs that utilize policy strategies to change and influence social norms, systems, and networks in which this would be an example. To be clear, tobacco use is the number one cause of preventable death in Oregon and Multnomah County. Multnomah County spends almost $400 million a year on medical care and lost productivity. 24,000 people have serious illnesses that are caused by tobacco use, and I've provided a fact sheet where you can continue to look at the numbers as they relate to Multnomah County. I want to highlight that in Oregon, 90% of a current adult smoker started using tobacco before the age of 18. And distributing free samples is a deliberate method of the tobacco industry. And was, as mentioned, a centerpiece of the Camel Snus campaign, which was targeted in Portland, which is where Multnomah County resides. Currently, the tobacco company is using Portland for a test market to market flavored dissolvable tobacco products like strips and orbs and sticks. I just wanted to mention a story of a couple of my colleagues who went in to purchase a pack of orbs for presentation purposes and educational purposes, and they were handed three free samples. At that time, they told the clerk, "No, we don't want these. We really, really don't want these." And she said, "Yes, yes, you must take them. They're free." So that is an example of the amount of free tobacco that people are getting. Let's see. without this legislation, free tobacco samples will still be available in Oregon and can get into the hands of youth. Please take these facts into consideration as you consider House Bill 2358, which will give Multnomah County an effective way to keep free tobacco out of the hands of children, reduce youth initiation to tobacco, and counter a glamorized pro-tobacco images which are devoid of the pain, suffering, and addiction that are realities with tobacco use. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Randy?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Randy Harris, and I am the Tobacco Prevention Coordinator for Polk County. Now, we're a very rural community, and we experience a higher prevalence of smokeless tobacco rates, not only with our adults, but also with our youth, and this is very alarming. We're not the only rural county in Oregon to experience this. In fact, it's a very common thread. As smoking bans are becoming the norm across the country, tobacco companies are coming up with new ways to market new products, and they're doing that in forms of smokeless tobacco. And they are sampling them, as Rachel said, as a test market here in Oregon and in Portland. In fact, right now, if you go to buy a pack of cigarettes at any retail store, they will give you a sample of Camel Orbs, which are little dissolvable. They look like little breath mints, little pieces of candy. So these are getting out to smokers, and they're marketing them to use them. Now, you know, you can't smoke in bars, so here, go ahead and use this tobacco product. As you can see from those samples that were passed around, they're brightly colored. They come in flavors such as frost and spice. So these are not appealing to adults. These are appealing to youth. By allowing tobacco companies to distribute these samples of the non-cigarette tobacco products throughout our communities, we are essentially promoting disease, death, and mortality. We're also making it easy for our youth to get these free products and giving tobacco companies their next customers. In the House testimony, there was a 13-year-old girl, a tiny little girl from Jefferson County, and she went to one of these free sampling, it was a rodeo or something. She got three full packs of chewed tobacco. This little tiny girl with this quote-unquote sample of three full packs of chewed tobacco. So this is getting to our youth. It is trickling down, and we are strongly opposed to the amendment that's been presented today. This will not solve the problem of the tobacco trickling down. We need to just ban it completely and eliminate Oregon as a test market for these tobacco companies. So without this legislation, free samples of non-cigarette tobacco products will continue to be available in Oregon, increasing the number of our youth who will become big tobacco's next victim. Thank you so much for taking the time to consider this important issue.
Thank you. Questions for the panel?
I have a quick question, Mr. Chair. Do any of you know the details of the Washington ban? Is it a complete ban or is it age-based?
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. The Washington ban is very similar to the legislation that is in front of you, the bill. It is not age-based, so this bill, but without the amendments.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Ladies, thank you very much for coming forward. I've got Mo Spencer and Raquel, and it's Born something after that. I can't read it. So.
Born
and S. Okay. Sorry for the... And was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2358? All right. Whoever wants to go.
Good morning. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'll be brief. My name is Mo Spencer. I'm the State Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. ACS-CAN, as we're called, is an advocate affiliate of the American Cancer Society. We're here to support 2358, the bill that prohibits distribution of free samples of cigarette tobacco products. And we also vehemently oppose these DAS 3 amendments. They're problematic, especially raising the age from 18 to 21 and only having adult areas that can be sampled. We just feel that's very problematic. We know that banning free sampling of tobacco products works. The Federal Disease Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention found that banning sampling is an effective way to keep kids from tobacco. So I'm going to end there, but again, I want to say that we oppose the amendments. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I'm Raquel Bornanesk with Upstream Public Health. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing innovative policies that keep people healthy. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 2358. The tobacco industry spends $130 million on marketing, sampling, and promotion each year in Oregon. And when you do that math, the tobacco industry is actually outspending the state's tobacco prevention program 15-1. So why is the tobacco industry spending $130 million on promotion? Because advertising and sampling works. And it's especially effective on youth who are still forming their opinions about themselves.
The industry targets youth at places where youth and young adults congregate. They go to the hippest bars, the coolest festivals, the most popular rodeos. Sampling is an oversimplified term for what's actually occurring. Young people are singled out and approached, given free products, coupons, giveaways, and sometimes their IDs are checked. So in one quick swipe of the driver's license, the industry has now collected all the information needed to repeatedly target them by mail and email, with hundreds of coupons, gifts, and special offers, which arrive straight to their homes. The Dastrey amendments would limit the bill's scope to only banning free sampling to people under 21, and Upstream Public Health is firmly against this amendment. In a perfect world, youth under 21 wouldn't end up where they're not supposed to be, but we frankly don't live in that perfect world. This age restriction limit would only be a big win for tobacco. We all know that youth are more likely to try tobacco products and become addicted if it's readily available. Passing this bill, as is, without the amendment, will have a positive effect on young Oregonians and will prevent another generation of youth from becoming addicted.
All right, thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2358, and we're going to start with our next hearing, which is going to be a kind of a companion, House Bill 2136A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2136A prohibits distribution of tobacco products from vending machines except in bars, taverns, or lounges posted as off-limits to minors. There's an A4 amendment. The A4 amendment allows vending machines in any establishment where the premises are off-limits to minors. There is a revenue statement that is issued and no fiscal impact.
All right, I've got Dr. Hedberg again, Rachel Banks, and Mo Spencer. Was there anyone else that wanted to give testimony today on this companion bill, House Bill 2136A? Not seeing one. All right, so since we've already heard testimony on the first bill, we would like for you to just summarize as to why you are for or against this bill and not go through the previous testimony.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, I am Dr. Katrina Hedberg, the interim state epidemiologist with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2130A, which would prohibit the sale of tobacco products through vending machines. This bill was introduced on our behalf by the governor. Tobacco use is the number one preventable cause of death. In 2005, almost 7,000 Oregonians died. That's 22% of all deaths were attributable to tobacco. It costs Oregon every year $1.1 billion in lost wages and productivity and over $1 billion in direct medical expenditures. My testimony is being handed out, as is a copy of our tobacco prevention and education program report. So in the benefit of time here, I won't cover everything that's in my written testimony, but let's just say that vending machines are another way to have easy access to tobacco products. And one of the things that the Centers for Disease Control has mentioned in a comprehensive tobacco prevention and control program, and I think that was alluded to earlier, but is limiting access to tobacco products as one way to decrease cigarette use and tobacco use, and particularly the access to minors. Now, the amendment, which we would be in support of, really talks about limiting. Vending machines would, under this legislation, be allowed in places that only had access to 21 and older, and we would like the amendment to specifically state that that is equivalent to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's posting of no access to minors. So this would not just be a place that at the front door said that minors could not enter, but rather is posted posted, similar to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So I think with that, I'll probably stop my testimony since, again, the dangers of tobacco use we talked about in the previous testimony, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you. Rachel?
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. Once again, for the record, my name is Rachel Banks with the Multnomah County Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. Simply put, vending machines create opportunities for youth to access tobacco. People in Oregon do not want youth to have access to tobacco. In fact, 98% of adults acknowledge the importance of ensuring that retail stores do not sell tobacco to minors. And Oregon has laws that require vendor assistance for tobacco in all retail environments. However, many vending machines are located outside of retail environments. In our efforts to reduce the harmful impacts of tobacco, our staff have encountered vending machines that are not easily monitored by staff, that are in hallways, that are next to exits, and so on and so forth. With my testimony, I've handed out pictures which help to suggest that vending machines suggest a universal access and availability to cigarettes in society. And you'll see on the first photo that there's a vending machine where it has chips and snacks, and at the bottom, which would be a child's level, are cigarettes in the same vending machine with other products. There's another photo of Rest in Peace above a Camel machine, which I just thought was ironic, and then a photo taken of a vending machine, a newer version of a vending machine that is similar to video lottery or automated that we've seen out in the field. So once again, please take these facts into consideration, and we at Multnomah County support this amendment in limiting youth access to tobacco.
All right, thank you. Mo.
Chair Brzezinski,
members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Mo Spencer. I'm the State Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And I'll be brief again. The Cancer Society supports House Bill 2136 specifically because this bill, by prohibiting the sale of tobacco, and these vending machines, we all know what vending machines are. They're an old relic, but yet they're still around, these old relics. And the problem is that children have access to these. And these tobacco products used in this vending machine will, if we can prohibit that, the Cancer Society feels that we will be able to decrease access to tobacco products among children and youth. And for the Cancer Society, if we can limit that, that's important to us because that will help eradicate cancer. So, again, we ask you to please support House Bill 2136 and again, House Bill 2358. Thank you.
Thank you. Question, Senator Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for any or all of you. I don't know if you've seen the Dash 4 amendments, if you have any comments on those.
I have not seen the Dash
4. For 2136?
Dr. Hedberg testified that she supported it, and that's the one that has the limiting it to premises posted by the OLCC.
Okay,
that's fine, actually. For 2136, that Dash 4 amendment is fine because it is confined to OLCC regulations. So the Dash 4 amendment for this one is great. It's fine. The Dash 3 amendments for the previous, for 2358, is completely problematic. And thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other, Senator, what's that?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. For any one of you, how many tobacco vending machines are there currently in Oregon? Where are they located, and what is the total volume of the sales?
That I don't know. Do you know?
I think there was testimony given on this, I think, during the House side. I can't remember the exact number, but the second answer to your question is, whereas vending machines used to be just in bars, but now you see them in hotels. They're in bars and hotels. And so whereas you may think, okay, well, if they're in bars, what's the problem? But I tell you, in hotels, anyone has access to that. So, you know, a 13-year-old kid has access to the vending machine. So the vending machines are tending to pop up, yes, in bars, but they're popping up in hotels, and they're popping up in other places where minors can get to them. So it's not just restricted to those places where, 21 and over.
Follow up?
Yes.
Yes.
Are they currently, I've never seen one in a convenience store, but then I live out in the rural area of Oregon. So, I mean, are they, are these vending machines currently popular in convenience stores and that sort of thing?
You know, in my, I haven't seen them either, but I don't know if you'll find them in convenience stores, because in the convenience stores, the tobacco products are behind the register. So it would be, you know, defeat the purpose to put them in a vending machine when you also have it behind the counter. I haven't seen it, and so I can't speak on that. But I would doubt if you'd see it there. But
so. Chair Przanski and Senator Whitsitt, my understanding is they are in both hotel lobbies, and there are also some work settings where they might be located.
Manufacturing plants.
Yes, manufacturing plants, and we know that, you know, as of the age of 16, while there are not a lot of youth who do work, there are some who get out into the workforce at a relatively young age, and so they might have access in that setting as well. In most grocery stores, of course, then they are not only behind the counter, but people are looking at IDs to make sure that they're only being sold to the correct age. So that's standard to have a vendor, to actually have a person look at someone buying other than with these vending machines.
One more question, please. Do you know who places and manages these vending machines? I mean, are there companies that do that? Or, I mean, where does that, how do they get there? And who manages them, and who makes a profit from them?
So I don't know that either.
No. Chair Przanski, Senator Winsett, I'm not sure of that, but I know that in the past, having friends who've worked in the industry, when tobacco companies show up to a convenience store, they tell the owner or give them ideas on how you may want to sell this and how you may want to do that. Do they also bring the vending machines with them? I don't know, in terms of who brings the vending machines, I think as far as we're concerned, it's problematic no matter who brings it. And the Cancer Society feels that it's still an issue in terms of having youngsters getting access to it, and that's a problem.
The question was aimed at who are we putting out of business here?
Thank you. All right. With that, thank you very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2136A. And we are going to move into a public hearing on House Bill 3094A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3094A extends the sunset for 4 years on the conditional exemption from disclosure of public records, the name, home address, or professional location of a person associated with medical research conducted on animals at OHSU. There's no amendment, no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I've got, looks like, four individuals who want to give testimony in support, and that's the group from OHSU, so Nancy, Steve, and Janet, and then Mary Botkin, if you want to come up and get a fourth chair. We got three there. Wonderful. And who wants to get started? Let's go for it.
Chairman Przanski, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Nancy Hagwood, for the record, director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center, and I am pleased to have the opportunity to discuss very briefly with you some of the issues that concern us. As you know from our previous testimony, we are one of eight national primate research centers funded by the National Institutes of Health, and our goal is to advance human and animal health. We reside on the OHSU West Campus in Beaverton, Hillsboro, and employ approximately 500 people, most of whom are involved in primate research. Our research has three main thrusts, and these include neuroscience or brain research, battling diseases such as MS and Parkinson's disease, and Alzheimer's and other diseases of aging. We also focus on fertility, including fertility treatments and treatment of children born prematurely, and diabetes and some of the effects of the American high-fat diet. And finally, infectious diseases, focusing on creating and improving vaccines and therapies for several different diseases, including AIDS and West Nile virus. Myself, I'm a microbiologist for the last 35 years, and for the last 20 of those or so, I've been working on AIDS vaccines and therapies to limit mother-to-child transmission. I just want to mention a piece of paper in your packet, which you've received, and that summarizes the focus of the oversight that our facility receives. We receive oversight at many levels, by the research facility itself and every individual experiment and every animal in the facility. I've discussed those details with you previously, and in the interest of time, I will not reiterate that point. This handout focuses on the USDA and its oversight concerning the Animal Welfare Act. Their job is to vigilantly enforce this act and to ensure the well-being of animals used in laboratory research, and they enforce standards of husbandry, record keeping, review of research protocols, and veterinary care. I have two colleagues with me today, our head veterinarian, Dr. Cynthia Doan, who is also the head of the Animal Resources Group, and our Dr. Christine Coleman, who is head of the Enrichment and Behavior Program at the Center, and both of these individuals are available for questions should you have any. The main purpose for my my being here today, and I'll just end on this note, is regarding this bill, 3094A. We think this is very good legislation because it strikes a balance and allows us to provide access of highly detailed information about our animal care and our research down to the very procedure, but it removes the names of individuals who are at times victims of harassment and illegal acts. All of our staff wish strongly for their personal information to be redacted because they feel threatened by home harassment and vandalism that has already been directed to our researchers and their families. And we are mindful of increasing violence on the West Coast, and we very much hope that you will continue to support the law that was established to protect them. And I am their spokesman today, and I wish that you would do so. And I would like to turn the discussion to my colleagues, Steve Statham and Janet Billups, who will talk more specifically about the challenges that OHSU researchers have faced and the extensive review process that OHSU uses when it receives records requests.
Good morning, Chair Pazanski, members of the committee. My name is Steve Statham, Executive Vice President of OHSU. I'd like to briefly comment in support of HB 3094A, which its purpose is to continue the current law, which was has been in place since 2003. Continuing the current law through House Bill 3094A does not limit access to information requested by the press or to oversight agencies that ensure the ethical treatment of animals at OHSU. In fact, when the law was first passed, the Senate Judiciary Committee asked us to continue to provide the same level of information to press requests because of the desire to use this tool sparingly, and we have done so. We understand the committee may like to re-examine this original policy, and OHSU would welcome the opportunity to work with this committee and other stakeholders in the interim on this issue, but of course we ask that the current law be extended while that review occurs. OHSU legal counsel Janet Billups will address our system for reviewing requests more fully during her testimony. This law is not intended to keep records from animal rights groups who request them. It's specifically intended to prevent harassment and violent acts directed at individual researchers and their families. In cases where records are redacted, these redactions are very limited, and requesters still receive highly detailed information about our use of animals in health research. We are providing you with a sample animal care record that from our primate center. It's in the packet that you've received, so you can see how limited those redactions are. I want to briefly share with you an example of a series of events which we think illustrate how the law does balance the public's right to know with the need to protect researchers and their families. Last year, the animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals requested a large number of OHSU documents, including primate animal care research, animal care records, and any reports we have filed with the federal government where a research protocol resulted in a negative outcome. And OHSU did provide these documents with the redactions allowed by the current law. PETA then reviewed the records, and based on this highly detailed information, they filed a complaint to the USDA. The USDA then conducted their own investigation, and of course USDA has full access to all of our information, including the names and addresses of the staff. This investigation in this case did result in a warning letter for the Primate Center. The result was promoted by PETA, as they had the right to do, and was the subject of an Oregonian story, which we are providing to you. It's in your information packets. And from my perspective, this series of events demonstrates nicely how organizations concerned about animals in research, such as PETA, are able to maintain access to the details about OHSU's research that they're looking for and to raise concerns when they have them. However, the names of individuals which have been the fuel for harassment, threats, and illegal acts have been disconnected from that process. And I'm not going to take the time right now
but I do want you to know that in your packet there is additional information. We have seen activists threaten to firebomb a researcher's home, and there have been more than 50 separate incidents involving masked individuals who have shown up at scientists' homes to harass their families and their children. So this is a very real concern, as Ms. Hegwood said. In addition to this illegal activity, I want to mention that OHSU has twice been infiltrated by animal rights groups who have placed their own employees at OHSU's Primate Center to conduct their own investigations. And I want you to know that in both of these cases, the federal government then conducted extensive investigations and the Primate Center was cleared and no fines were issued. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions later, I'll be glad to answer them.
Good morning.
Committee. My name is Janet Phillips. I'm legal counsel with the Oregon Health and Science University. I will talk about how we currently use the law and how we track our use of the law. In the log that we provided to you, we highlighted cases where redactions have been made. They have all been made in the interest of research security. That is, to our view, the entire point of this statute.
In 2003, when the Senate Judiciary Committee first considered this issue,
we were asked to not use the law as a tool to withhold information from the mainstream media. We promised to act responsibly along those lines, and we've kept that promise. In other cases, we do err on the side of caution to ensure employees' safety. This public records exemption falls within the category of conditional exemptions as opposed to the second category of unconditional, which is unconditional. In this case, since it is a conditional exemption, what we have to do is balance the public's interest in disclosure against the public's interest in nondisclosure, and the presumption is always in favor of disclosure. In 2005, OHSU's use of this statute was challenged and was analyzed by the Court of Appeals, who considered the same argument that you have heard or will hear from opponents. That is, that they need the names of individuals in order to carry out a watchdog role regarding animal care. The court reviewed the evidence and concluded that, and this is a quote, "the plaintiff's purpose of ensuring the proper treatment of the animals housed at the Primate Center is not dependent on receiving the names of specific employees." The court also went on to review the evidence of mounting violence in general against medical researchers. We have not engaged in finger-pointing of certain entities, organizations, or people, but rather, as here, have described the evidence of a campaign of terror that has happened across this country and in the West in particular. And based on that evidence, the court also concluded, again, I quote, that the evidence was sufficient to demonstrate a significant interest on the part of OHSU in nondisclosure. As a result, the court ruled that OHSU need not disclose names because, to reiterate, the public's interest in ensuring the careful care of animals is not dependent on disclosure of employee names. Every animal medical record is available to anyone without regard to their reason or their intended use of that information
Janet,
on material.
I'll ask you a question, and I'm going to try to move us a little faster on this. The case you're citing from, can you give us a citation on that?
It is In Defense of Animals versus OHSU. I don't have the citation. It's a 2005 case, Court of Appeals. Justice Armstrong was the author.
All right. If you could get that to us, we'd appreciate that.
I can get it at the end of our testimony.
And is there any other stuff that you need to put on the record? I think what you've given us is pretty sufficient. See what type of poll I get.
At this time, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Excellent answer. Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. We represent the folks who work at the Primate Center other than the researchers. And we are here in support of this bill. We supported the original exemption because of threats that employees were faced with. We understand that even with the redaction of names and withholding personal information, that there's nothing that stops animal rights activists from following folks home. But we think that this deters the less aggressive members of these groups. And I just want to say, by way of self-disclosure, you know, I am an MS patient. I think I want these people to do everything they can to find a cure, you know, and I don't want anybody to get in their way, and if they need to use animals to experiment with, then I'll sign up for the second round of experimentation.
All right.
You know? They do very important work up there. We're not testing hairspray and mascara. You know, this is important medical research that will save lives. And the practice of domestic terrorism to keep our researchers from doing their work is not appropriate.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And I recall the presentation that we had in the prior hearing, and I looked at the photographs that you just cast out and find them, you know, completely unacceptable, but probably violate existing criminal law. And so I wonder if you could address the concern, if in fact the concern is the safety, which we all are concerned about, the safety of the researchers, then why isn't the sufficient law that allows them to have their addresses and emails and personal numbers all removed from the public records sufficient? And I'm still trying to justify the need for the bill when you still put their pictures and names on the OHSU website.
Senator Prezansky, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you for the question. The website material we post is informative and somewhat general, but we hope very informative on a certain level of detail. That kind of information about science and the people who are carrying out science is not the information that is needed or used by criminal elements, frankly, who wish to end animal research. The information that is needed and used is the detailed description of what happens to the animals as described in the animal medical record. And, for example, there are descriptions, in a clinical level of surgeries that are carried out on animals. Even at its most clinical description, that is not pleasant reading. That information is very often connected with researchers as well as individual staff members who participate in the surgery. That information is taken and distorted, taken out of context, preached, and used in order to incite violence. All of those things are completely lawful. Anyone who wants to lie about research can take the information in animal medical records and do that. They can lie, they can distort. That's their right. OHSU has no interest or ability to regulate that activity. What we need is this balance of disconnecting the names of people who participate in specific research conduct from that description, so that those people are not used as poster children with a, hey, go out and get them, invitation to those who wish to end medical research involving animals. The information itself is completely open. We have no intent or ability to withhold the information about the medical research, but it's that connection on a very detailed level in the type of record you see before you that is needed and used.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I don't work in the criminal world. This judiciary thing is all new to me, but I work in the counterterrorism and anti-terrorism world, and we use pictures. So I know police use pictures, too. So I think as a follow-up to Senator Bonamici's question, as long as you have a picture on there, they're going to print that picture, these elements you're talking about, and wait outside the front door. So I would recommend, if you want to do something similar to this and really protect it, you better take the pictures off the Internet.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. The last two people I have scheduled for this one is Andrew Meyer and Matt Russell. So come on up. Sorry.
We open it. You're getting excited, Mr. Chair. There's 30 more bills to go.
Good morning, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. Andrew Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm having written testimony distributed. I am not reading my written testimony. I want to highlight ACLU's continued opposition to this proposal and why. We oppose this broad exception, and to clarify, ACLU has no opposition to the home address, email, home phone number of these individuals being redacted from public record. We believe ORS 192-445 for public safety already does that. But what you've heard is this goes much further and redacts a person's name from publicly created work documents with our public resources. And I believe, with all due respect, this law has been misused. They are talking about, the argument is that with this kind of information, folks will spread misinformation. But the reality is, if you only release partial information, the only thing that can be spread is misinformation, fanning of the flames, and ultimately censorship. We need complete records for review for public oversight, even when the records lead to unfavorable media coverage or questionable treatment. OHSU argues that this law is the difference between their safety and harm, that a name appearing on a public document is the trigger for criminal activity. But that's not correct. Those engaged in criminal activity do not need this to give them the fuel to engage in their own activity. And indeed, as Senator Boquist has identified and Senator Bonamici, OHSU undermined its own claim for public safety by including not only the name and the research work, but the photographs of these researchers. I've attached them to my testimony. I've attached their homepage with some of their leadership and their photos. I then attached photos. I did not put their names, but I attached the next page with links to their names. I'd say 90% of the researchers have photographs on their website. And I want to speak about this idea of advocacy organizations equaling terrorism or criminals, because we seem to be going to an extreme. And the same could be said, and incorrectly so, about advocates against abortion. There are protesters out there who oppose abortion. They may speak in community centers. They may carry signs in front of clinics. They may carry signs that say murder happens here. They may carry even more graphic signs, but no one would suggest that that lawful activity and those individuals who are engaged in that lawful activity of oversight and public advocacy could be held responsible or are indeed even fanning the flames of that criminal element out there who wants to attack abortion providers or clinics. We do not stop the public advocacy and the airing of information because of those out there who want to do criminal activity. We go after the criminals. With all due respect, you've received some material now from OHSU talking about, they say, we provide this to the mainstream media. The public records law does not distinguish between media and other parties, particularly watchdog organizations. And I want to briefly quote from the Attorney General Manual, which states about the public record disclosure: interested persons, news media representatives, business people seeking access for personal gain, busybodies on fishing expeditions, persons seeking to embarrass government agencies, and scientific researchers all stand on equal footing. But that is not true. OHSU has provided a document telling you how they handle it for one, mainstream media, and two, animal research oversight watchdog groups. They are all treated in one box or the other. OHSU has not only treated all oversight watchdog groups by invoking the redaction law, they've also delayed, if they've never even provided the documents, for years. And these are some of the same organizations that have exposed the activities and actions that, when brought to the public attention, has resulted in change. The OHSU said their presumption is disclosure, but with all due respect, I have reviewed the dockets that they provided 4 years ago and the docket that they have again provided this year. And the reasons they put for 4 years ago why they refused to release to PETA was in a details column they added. In the past, PETA has spread damaging but false information about OHSU animal care.
False information, even damaging information, is not the standard. Public agencies across the state would invoke the same thing. Even when legislators are asking for that information, it may take to the floor of the Senate or the House or a press conference spreading information about the agency's actions. The pattern continues to this day. If the standard were false information or damaging information, then little to no public records would be made available. Indeed, it is true. Probably every public agency and department, if asked, does not like releasing documents about themselves that might expose wrongdoing, mishandling, embarrassing features or factors, but they must and they should. And OHSU is a public agency that cannot pick and choose favorable press or indeed press over everyone else. Having the names of the researchers on documents uncovered monkey self-mutilation, having these public records also in the late 1990s, disclosed that
Clackamas
County Animal Shelter was selling dogs to OHSU.
Can you try and speed it up here?
And I'm almost at the conclusion. And the one result we've seen with that exposure was sunshine and change. Again, home addresses can and should be, but this goes too far. And we urge you not to proceed with this session and let them invoke the public safety exception under current Oregon law. Thank you.
Matt?
Hi, my name is Matt Roselle, and Senator Brzezinski and members of the committee, I really appreciate this chance to speak with you. I haven't had a chance to meet all of you yet. I work for In Defense of Animals. We're a legal watchdog organization, has a 25-year history of benefiting the public through using document requests and whistleblower testimony to shed light on institutions that are in violation of federal law and are doing research that is not benefiting people. I also worked for 2 years as a technician at OHSU. Diligently, I'm one of the people they mentioned, not as an infiltrator, but as an advocate from the inside, working very hard to change the system from within and beating my head against the wall for 2 years. And it is when the information that I saw there came to light is when real change happened. And that is an example of why it's very important to be able to shed light on public institutions. It actually, as much as OHSU has tried to discredit me, it actually benefits the public. And many sweeping changes happened after I left, all the while they were trying to deny that anything that I said was true. If HB 3094 passes, it is not going to do what OHSU says it's going to do. It's not going to protect their researchers. There's some specific examples. I've given you some of the... This document here has two examples of documents from that request that they cited as an example of why the names aren't important. I'm going to tell you why they are important. The first one with the OHSU logo on the front, this is an IACUC, Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, meeting minutes. Very innocuous. It's a very common thing that people like us would request. It has, it's the internal sort of, every institution has their own committee like this to approve protocols. This is kind of the first line of defense to make sure that the research is valuable, the animals are being treated well. So this does not have information that's highly sensitive. It's very general descriptions, although they've redacted every single name, including the members of the committee. Every investigator has been redacted. There's nothing inflammatory in here. But what this really does is it cripples us into really being able to make sure that the research has value. We would take the researchers' names and we would do literature searches. We'd see what else other work they've done. We would compare it with other work that they've done possibly at other institutions, because a lot of these researchers travel between two different places. This really ties our hands. These numbers, these protocol numbers do not match up with the numbers given by the NIH at a federal level. So there's no way to connect the dots between FOIA requests that we get from the feds that have names to these protocols. It really diminishes our work, and it hides these researchers from the public scrutiny that they really deserve. The back is an example of an egregious citation that actually resulted in some disciplinary action. This is a document that shows that a mother monkey who was pregnant and having trouble delivering, that the primary investigator kept a veterinarian from doing a life-saving C-section on this monkey, and the result was both monkeys died. Well, they're claiming, well, it worked. You got the records, and you were able to alert the USDA, and they did action. But what this doesn't allow us to do is it doesn't allow us to look at who this is and find out if they have other non-compliant issues. They're really hiding this researcher from public scrutiny to find out if there's more going on here, which we definitely would do if we could, but we can't. Talk a little bit about their claim that it's the level of detail in the information. Here's something that I printed off the internet last night. This is an OHSU paper. It was published recently. This goes into graphic detail. This is, if someone were an anonymous criminal who wanted to get information, it would be far easier for them to go to the NIH website from a public computer and print this off. It has graphic detail of inducing a stroke by removing an eyeball and drilling into the brain of a monkey through the eye socket. This is very typical. Their published papers with their names on it are published on these websites. The information is in the public domain. They also have a CRISP website that you can do searches. You can plug in OHSU and Primate, and you can get the names of all the researchers. And in addition, it's been said more than once that they have their own pictures published on the website. So it's just not true that these criminals can't find this information. We do not support that criminal behavior. We think it's counterproductive. We think it's unlawful. We don't condone it or participate in it, but this law will simply not do what they claim. And in terms of the transparency that OHSU is claiming, I'd like to say that we have twice had to file lawsuits to get public documents. A document request once took us 8 years to finally work its way through court, and we've always prevailed when we file lawsuits, but how valuable is the information when it's 8 years old? In the case of the exact court case that they cited as an example, in that case, the testimony of OHSU employees highlighted the fact that OHSU was willing to spend an extra $20,000 to make sure that we got those documents in hard copy instead of an electronic copy, because I believe it's a lot more difficult to review 113,000 pages if you have a giant pile of boxes of paper and reams of paper instead of having it on a disk where you can review things online on screen.
I need you to wrap up, please.
Okay, so I just want to say that when you shine more light on these institutions, it improves the research, and this law is really going to tie the hands of people who are diligently trying to make sure that they're adhering to the law. And thanks for your time.
All right, thank you. Questions for this panel? Not seeing anyone. This is a public hearing on House Bill 30.
And I think Mr. Rozell would like to just leave you with a copy of this magazine. So
I'm closing the public hearing on 3094A, and we're going to open up. See. Max Williams in yet? Don't see.
Yeah,
oh, there he is. Excellent. All right, open up House Bill 2292A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2292A provides that the Department of Corrections may enter into a contract with a public entity for correctional services in a facility located in another state, declares an emergency effective upon passage. There's an A4 amendment that adds a 4-year sunset. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and this one's ready to move. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and before, Max, before we get started, Mary, were you going to testify? Your name's here, but doesn't say if you are or aren't. Okay. And David Rogers, I'm assuming, is going to testify. Once you come on up, Max, go ahead and get us started.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2292, along with the dash A4 amendments, which you should have in front of you at this time. This is a bill essentially designed to allow the department to continue with its current legally authorized ability to contract for the use of out-of-state prison beds from public entities if it needs to do so, given
either changes in sentencing policy or issues where the department has ran out of space. I want to assure the committee that we currently don't have any intention to use this law. None of our current planning assumes, even in the face of ballot measure 57 and the other issues that we're dealing with, is currently considering the use of any out-of-state rental beds. But the bill that authorized this in 2001 sunsets at the end of this year. So at the end of 2009, the department would lose the ability, if it needed to do any kind of contracting for out-of-state beds. Initially, both in 2001 and again in this session, there's been some discussion about whether or not it would include the use of private prison beds. It was excluded from the bill in the 2001 legislative session. It's again in the version version that you got from the House. It remains solely limited to the use of public prison beds out of state if the department needed them. And then in conversations with the chair, we agreed again to the inclusion in the Dash A4 amendments, which really solely makes the change of including a sunset, an additional sunset of January 2nd, 2014 on the authorization, meaning that the department would need to come forward again in 2013 or 14, given however the sessions are structured, to seek that reauthorization if it was necessary. Again, we're not really intending to use this, but I felt like and continue to feel as though it's in the department's best interest to have the flexibility necessary for a variety of factors, whether it's from a crowding issue inside our facilities or, God forbid, some catastrophic problem where we actually lost a complete institution or more than one institution, to allow us the legal flexibility to potentially use out-of-state prison beds. It's not our preference. Certainly Oregon's prior experience with out-of-state prison beds was far from ideal, but it is the flexibility from an operational standpoint that we feel like we need to continue to maintain. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony, and I do have written testimony that I can submit to the committee as well.
All right. Thank you. David?
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. I'm the Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice, and I think that we essentially oppose this bill. We're not sure that it's necessary, given the fact that DOC has, at the current moment, an extraordinary amount of open bed space when compared to prison population projections. I will say, though, if from Mac's perspective, if I was him, I'd certainly want the flexibility to deal with situations that come up, and so I can understand him advocating for this. There are clearly plenty of reasons why it's a bad idea for us to ever use this policy if it continues to be enacted, because sending prisoners out of state certainly has a bad public safety outcome. It increases the likelihood of recidivism. It's not necessarily cost-effective, and Max actually really, in a detailed way and eloquently, spoke just last Friday about all of the reasons why he doesn't think it's cost-effective or good policy. I just think it's worth noting, though, that I think the intention of the bill is to try and limit the ability of Oregon DOC to be able to send, if necessary, prisoners to publicly owned and operated prisons. And I think that there's actually a loophole in the way that this is written that really needs to be tightened up. For example, Idaho is a state, for example, that owns prisons, but then has privately run correction facilities operate them. And, I'm going to spare you the really detailed research and case studies from around the country that show how bad the conditions are in private prisons. And, of course, the history that Oregon has that Max alluded to, when we sent female prisoners out of state to Arizona, what resulted was that, we had several female prisoners that were sexually assaulted and raped, which really spoke to the really horrible conditions in privately operated prisons. So I think that one of the things that we're recommending, if the committee and the legislature feels that this bill needs to move forward, we would really like to see some language that tightens up to ensure that that we're not sending prisoners to privately run or owned facilities. And right now, I don't think that the language is clear enough, given the Idaho example, where the state actually owns prisons but lets private correctional facilities operate them. And then the second recommendation that we want to make, if the legislature feels that this is something that is important to enact, from the previous legislation, there was language that's been stripped out of this version, language that I've included in the written testimony that does two things. First of all, ensures that if DOC is considering the possibility of sending people under their care and custody out of state, that we first make sure that there aren't available local jail beds in state. Because keeping people close to home will always have a better outcome. That language has been stripped out. And then second of all, there's language in there that also asked the DOC to essentially evaluate if the cost effectiveness of the option, as well as available programs that encourage rehabilitation available to the institutions that they would be considering sending people out of state to. We actually think that language, although in the last bill was could be tightened up and a little clearer, really important from a policy perspective, and we would love to see it. And we're not sure why it's been taken out of this version. We would certainly like to see it put back in because we think that the legislature got it right the first time. That is, again, if you want to move this bill forward. So those would be the two recommendations that we're making.
All right. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
I just have a quick one.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I wanted to ask the panel about the and the Dash 4 amendments. It seems to say that when this is used, it needs to be a correctional facility owned or operated by the public entity. So do you think that does not address the Idaho problem?
You know, admittedly, I actually hadn't seen the latest amendment. So if that has been, if that is the language, I actually think it does address the issue that I'm raising, the first issue that I'm raising. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, it's certainly the department's intent, and it's been our understanding of the language, that it would prohibit the Department of Corrections in Oregon from contracting for the use of any out-of-state prison beds that were either owned or operated by a private entity. This is solely designed to allow us the flexibility to contract with another public entity. Typically, that would be another state Department of Corrections who is owning and operating their own facility, or in some rare case, one might imagine a large jail facility. I don't want to disagree with Mr. Rogers about the likelihood is the department would seek, before it ever considered going out of state, the possible use of in-state jail beds. We use in-state jail beds all the time now. We don't need any statutory authorization to be able to do that. Our current statutory authorization in our enabling legislation gives us the ability to do that. We simply don't have the opportunity to do that outside of the state contracting. So I believe that subsection 3A, large A, that you commented on, Senator Bonamici, in fact, does address that sufficiently, that we would not ever consider the possibility of using any private owned or operated beds.
Thank you for the clarification.
Any other questions? Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2292A?
Senator Presidency, could I say something very quickly?
May.
Thank you. So I recognize that DOC is just looking for the authorization to do this. I would like to encourage you to consider providing actually some guidelines around that. And although I actually very much trust that Mr. Williams would consider using Oregon-based jail facilities beforehand, I think it's actually a good policy to try and for the legislature to encourage and ensure that happens.
I understand. Here's the situation. Tomorrow's our last day for meetings. We don't have time to have any other amendments, so the chair's ready to move forward. So I want to close the public hearing on the work session 2292A.
Mr. Chair, move the A4 into 2292.
All right. Senator Boquist moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2292A. Any discussion? The chair's going to put on the record. I'm comfortable, based on the testimony heard today from the director, as to how they would use this if they needed to use it. You and I have had an offline conversation as to my concern for ever seeing us use any type of privately owned or operated facility for any of our state prisoners, and he's assured me that is not going to happen, and he's now put that on the record.
And the other part is knowing the inflexibility that is necessary for this department to carry out its mission. I believe this is the next best step as compared to bringing something else online in-state when we are at this point not needing to bring a full facility on at this time in our budget situation. Any other questions or comments or discussion? Any objection to the Dash 4 amendments?
Mr. Chair, move HB 2292A as amended with the A4 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist now moves House Bill 2292A as amended with the Dash 4s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I will support the bill with the clarification, so thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'm actually going to be a no on this. I understand what the intent is, but there's a for my county, Multnomah County, we have had for, I want to say, 4 or 5 years. I'm sure Max knows the exact amount. We've had an empty jail. It's costing the taxpayers a lot of money.
I've got a bill for you.
Yeah, and I've talked
and
to the...
It becomes state-owned, too.
Yeah, I've talked to the director about it, and I know that they're working closely with Multnomah County, but we, and I'm not saying that it was the correct thing to build the jail as it was built without the money to operate it, but we've been trying now for years to coordinate with the state because we do have excellent facility available, especially for Measure 57 folks, because it has the opportunity for treatment. So I'm going to be a no on that for this reason, is because I don't want to make it easier, actually, for the state to look, for Department of Corrections to look outside the state when we do have facilities here that are being underutilized.
All right, I should have brought that other bill, the eminent domain one. All right, any other comments?
Just an interesting comment. In public safety, we were looking at the projected cost of that new facility in Junction City. Turns out to be, with the debt service, about $400,000 a bed, which figures out to just about $55 a night for debt service for 20 years.
All right. All right, any other objections to the passage of the motion, with the exception of Senator Dingfelder? Self-order. And Senator Boquist, do you want to carry this one? And Senator Boquist will be our carrier. Our last public hearing that we have scheduled for today is on House Bill 2988A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2988A directs the Child Care Division of the Employment Department to establish a voluntary central background registry as a voluntary registry for applicants who are employees or volunteers providing child care services and required by an agency or organization to complete a background check. It authorizes fees to recoup the cost of the program. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, the only person I have currently scheduled to give testimony is Andrea Meyer. Is there anyone here from the employment? Come on up. Andrea, come on up.
Sure.
We've got room for two people. We have room for three people.
Oh, we have a mediator.
Got three chairs. Right. How many can you want?
All right, let's get going. We've got 17 minutes left today.
All right.
A lot more to do.
You betcha. Chair Prozonsky and members of the committee, my name is Heidi McGowan, and I'm here on behalf of Rosetta Wongren, the chair of the Commission for Child Care. This is a bill that will create a voluntary background registry clearinghouse that can be used by multiple agencies. The Commission for Child Care is an advisory body to the legislature, an 18-member volunteer board that is charged with advising the governor and legislature on issues of child care. And in an effort to create an efficient, cost-effective system for the child care workforce, the Commission is pleased to support this legislation that will create a voluntary background registry clearinghouse that can be used by multiple agencies. For example, a child care provider who is required to obtain a background history through the Child Care Division. If they also work as an assistant in an elementary school, they currently are required to obtain another background registry check through the Department of Ed. This legislation would create a clearinghouse so that this child care provider would only have to submit to one background history and be cleared to work in two separate systems. Only individuals who have no criminal history in their backgrounds would be eligible to apply to this voluntary background registry, and those who fail to qualify for enrollment in the background registry because of a criminal activity reported in their background would still be eligible to work at another agency if that agency determined that they were eligible through their own criminal history fitness determination. The Commission for Child Care is a resource to hear for you. We look forward to working with you as we move forward.
Hey, could you give us your name again, Heidi?
Sure. Heidi McGowan, Executive Heidi. Officer of the Commission for Child Care.
Okay, great.
Andrea? Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here in opposition to House Bill 2988. I testified briefly on the House side raising some concerns and then had to sit down with the child care folks and flesh out a little bit more about what they're doing, which only raised more concerns to us. The types of criminal history background checks that we're talking about are those FBI nationwide criminal history background checks taken on the basis of a fingerprint. And in brief, we think this is the wrong approach. This would allow someone who has no criminal history to have their name entered into a registry. But as best I understand, this is going to be added to a database that is strictly secure and limited in access to who can use it right now, and would allow local agencies and volunteer organizations and a far more number of folks access that registry for purposes of looking up whether someone is in the clean box. And I think the database and the cost related to creating a system that limits access greatly to the major part of the database but opens up a wide part is one concern to us. Two, we think the approach to having the problem of multiple criminal history background checks needs to be done with all the stakeholders. We have some ideas that would not set up a database and possibly penalize those who have very modest or old criminal histories but who would qualify under a fitness test to not distinguish them between people who have no criminal history. We would be eager to meet and talk with all the agencies about this ongoing issue rather than setting up this model, which I know will be the basis for which every other agency will start using next session or the following sessions, as is consistent with this whole area of law.
Thank you. Were you here for questions or?
Chair Krasinski, members of the committee, my name is Tom Olson. I'm administrator of the Child Care Division. I'm here as a resource since we would be the agency that would administer this. And the only thing I might add is that when we began this process a long time ago, the Commission on Children and Families asked me if I would take the lead to set up a task force to look at the issues around this multiple background check problem. It came up from the local commission plans in their planning process. It turned out to be a significant issue for people that want to work in multiple early childhood settings, but continually we're winding up having to have yet another criminal history check. We worked with all the stakeholders available to us at the time, and the one thing that we found out was that there was no single criminal history check that would satisfy each agency. Everyone has their own fitness determination. And so the final realization we came to is that the only way that this would work, and it would work for about 85% of the population, is if we established a voluntary criminal history registry that for folks that had no criminal history in their background, they could apply to be in this registry, purely voluntary, and that those folks could then work in multiple child care settings since they have no criminal history in their background. It was designed purely to save money, to save time, to save convenience for the many people that work in early childhood in the state of Oregon. We are neutral on this bill. We will administer it if it passes. But the bill is put forward simply as a matter of convenience to make it easier for folks that work in early childhood to work in multiple settings.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Boquist first, Senator Wissett next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, in my line of work, we do between 50 and 300 quarterly background checks, which vastly exceeds the minimum fiscal in the legislature in a yearly basis. Can you explain why there's no fiscal when you're doing a quarterly background check at the FBI level?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, Child Care Division currently has a central background registry that we have approximately 30,000 to 40,000 individuals on. It's automated. It's well operated. We can do this with we've looked at it, and we can do this with existing staff resources. We don't think that the amount of work is going to be unduly onerous for us. If it is, we'll look at maybe an LD position and would come back to ask for positions later. But at this point in time, we can fit it in.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So you're telling me you have 30,000 to 40,000 fingerprint cards on hand in the agency right now?
Sheriff Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, no. We do not keep the fingerprint cards.
All right, Senator Wissett's next.
Question's been answered.
All right, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Mr. Olson, in the bill it talks about fees that are established, and it has an amount that may not be exceeded for all the areas except this one. So do you have any sense of what the fees would be?
I don't know.
For this program?
Sure. Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici. I'm going to ask Kathleen Hines to come up. She's looked at that.
Senator Brzezinski, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici. The fees that are involved in this legislation would be paid by the individual, and it is a cost of doing the FBI records check. So it's a pass-through.
I need you to put your name on the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Kathleen Hines. I'm the Legal and Compliance Manager with the Child Care Division.
Chair, yes. I understand that it is, but it doesn't have any amount on here, so I'm just trying to get a sense because there's several different categories. It says cost of administering the program, including fees for, and then it has all these lines, including the new enrollment in the registry, cost of administering the program, including fees for renewal, and the LEDS check. So are they duplicate fees, or is it just one FBI check? I'm just trying to get a sense of what the fees are going to be.
Okay.
I'll tell you what we're going to do. You can get that information back to us.
Yes.
We're at a stage here where I can read the tea leaves, as they would say. And at this point, I'm going to, unless there's someone else who wants to give testimony on 2988A, I'm closing the public hearing. Closed. All right. So at this point, we're going into our next mode, which is going to be work sessions that we have scheduled. We're going to do some of them. I can tell you that the number of the bills will be carried over. What I'm going to do is try to get through. We have three of our council here that will be working through. We're going to start with the ones that Lisa needs to take care of and go back and do other things. So I'm going to open up a work session first with House Bill 2759.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2759, you heard on May 19th. It creates a form for correcting errors in recorded trust deeds. You looked at the Dash 1 amendments. They add in another bill that allow a different recording of long-term care liens. We didn't adopt the Dash 1s that day because we were waiting to see how LC drafted the Dash 2s. The Dash 2s came back as a separate amendment. They were brought forward by an attorney with the title company who was part of the original sponsors, and their technical corrections. And we have no revenue and minimal fiscal on both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2.
And Lisa, if I remember correctly, when the committee heard this before, we were waiting to get the 2s to see if we needed to adopt the 1s and the 2s. Okay. Based on your testimony or your statements, we need both?
Yes, they were discrete amendments.
All right. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, move the A1s into 2759.
Senator Boquist moves the 1s into House Bill 2759.
I can't do both at the same time.
That's quite all right. No, we'll get this right. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the A2s into 2759.
Senator Boquist moves the 2s into House Bill 2759. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2759 to the floor as amended by the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2759 as amended by the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Bonamici, why don't you carry this one for us?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And we'll close the public, the work session on 2759. We'll now open up a work session on 2839A.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2839A is the bill amending Oregon's domestic partnership laws. You heard testimony on May 19th. You did adopt the amendment that day, the A4s. It simply deletes the emergency clause. There is no fiscal impact. There is a revenue statement issued on the bill. Because it allows domestic partnerships the same tax deduction as the married partners, there's a it will be a reduction in revenue collections for the state, estimated about $16,000.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, move 2839A to the floor with a due pass.
All right, Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2839A as amended by, what is it, the dash ones?
Dash four.
With the A4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Dingfelder will be our carrier on this one. We'll close that work session. We'll open the work session on House Bill 3077A.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3077A is the elective share bill that the Law Commission has been working so hard on. You heard it on May 19th. You did adopt the dash A5s at that time. They were technical corrections from the Commission and the State Bar. 3077A. And at the last meeting, you adopted the A5 amendments.
All right, so we've got our amendments in.
We were waiting for fiscal, which we got that. There's no revenue and minimal fiscal.
All right, and the A5s have been adopted?
That's right.
All right. Senator Boquist?
Mr. Chair, I move 3077A with the A5s to the floor with a due pass.
All right, Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3077 as amended by the A5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll be supporting the bill, but it's a 70% bill, so.
Okay.
Just make C.
All right. Any objection? So ordered, and Senator Bonamici, I ask that you carry this one as well. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3077A. And Lisa, that takes care of yours, I'm assuming. All right, and then Council, this one's yours.
2629.
All right, we're going to jump down to page 3, fourth from the bottom. It's House Bill 2629A. And I'm going to open up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
The work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2629A, we heard on May 22nd, bill imposes an additional fine for committing crimes of interfering with or assaulting a police animal. There is no amendment, no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2926A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2629A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Wissett, will you be our carrier? And we'll close that work session. And also, I think that takes care of yours.
I can go. Do you want Shannon to come over?
That'd be fine. You're there.
From there.
I'll take care of it from there.
Okay. Real quick. We're down to 3 minutes.
All right. So we're going back up to page one. It'll be page two on the work session, top of the page. And we're dropping down. And I'm going to open up a... let's see, that's going to be carried over. I've got this right. I think the next one that we're ready to move today is on House Bill 2175A.
House Bill 2175A broadens the class of non-Oregon convictions or adjudications that require a reporting as a sex offender, clarified current reporting requirements for juveniles and adult offenders, and you have an A3 amendment in front of the committee which provides that prior to allowing a juvenile offender from out of state to reside and be supervised in Oregon, the state would have to make a diligent effort to ensure that the sending state has notified the juvenile of their obligation to report as a sex offender in Oregon. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal. The A3 amendment is supported by, was brought forth by the Oregon Youth Authority.
Okay, so the A3 at this point is what we still need.
Mr. Chair, move.
Still pending.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, move the A3 into 2175A.
Yeah. All right, Senator Volquist moves the A3s into House Bill 2175.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, with the content of the A3, did we discuss that in the, I'm trying to remember. Is this a new idea in the A3?
Council?
Was it discussed in the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, during the public testimony, OIA submitted a draft copy of the A3 amendment. It was not sent to LC, so it was discussed at the time, is my understanding. I don't know if any questions were asked about it, but the language was before.
Any other discussions? Any objection to the A3s being adopted into 2175? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2175A as amended with the A3 to the floor with a due pass.
All right, Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2175A to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended by the A3s. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And volunteer on this one?
Sure.
Senator Boquist will be the carrier on 2175A. All right, the next one I have is House Bill 2478A. Open the public, excuse me, work session on it.
House Bill 2478A modifies the crime of sex abuse in the second degree to include intentionally propelling a dangerous substance at another person and clarifies that the act must be done with the intent to gratify the sexual desire of the offender. The A3 amendment that's in front of the committee modifies the current bill by categorizing the crime as a sex abuse in the third degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor. There's a minimal fiscal, no revenue impact.
All right, so basically what the amendment does on this, it moves it from a sex abuse 2 to a sex abuse 3. If you remember, the sponsor of the bill said they were fine with this change. So the chair will take a motion on the A3s.
Chair, move the A3 into 2478A.
Senator Boquist moves the A3s in the House Bill 2478. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, move House Bill 2478A as amended with the A3 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist now moves House Bill 2478 as amended by the A3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I support it if I don't have to carry.
Any objection? The chair will carry this one. One for the team.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take the next one that's in line, which is close that work session, an open work session on House Bill 3271A. No, it's not?
3271.
I apologize. That does say carryover. I didn't read it. Close the work session on that. And... Council, is 2874 ready?
Yes.
We'll open a work session on House Bill 2874A.
House Bill 2874A allows victims to assert the right to a speedy trial, creates a procedure for asserting the right to a speedy trial. The Dash 1 amendment was adopted on 5/26. There's no revenue and a minimal fiscal.
All right. Chair will take a motion regarding, I believe it's the Dash 1s, or did that one get incorporated? So it's been incorporated?
It's already in.
It is.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2874A as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass.
All right, Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2874 as amended by the A1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to support this bill, although I have some concerns about creating additional burdens on the Judicial Department, and also after sitting through many, many work group meetings with the Victims' Rights bill that we passed, Senate Bill 233, I'm a little baffled about why we have a separate bill dealing with that. Thought it should have been all taken care of in that one. But I'll support the bill with some concerns and reservations.
All right. Any other discussion?
Hey, Mr. Chair, this is a 90% bill for me, so I'll all support it, though, obviously. It's
all
about
right.
C.
All right.
Just get my son about C.
Any objection to the bill moving forward? Not hearing any, so ordered. And since you're a 90%er, do you want to carry this one? I'll tell you what, I'll carry this one. The chair is carrying this one, 2874. All right, the last one I'm going to take care of today, I believe, is at the toward the top, 2246. I believe that's conflict amendments.
Yes.
So we'll open up our work session on 2246A.
House Bill 2246A was modified the conditions under which a parent or guardian could give alcohol to a person under the age of 21 years. It was adopted and passed back on 5/21. A conflict amendment combines House Bill 2246 as amended with Senate Bill 227 in the event that 227 is passed. So it simply combines the two of them, and that's before the committee. It has no revenue and no fiscal impact.
All right. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, the A2 into 2246.
The question was the A2s in the House Bill 2246A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2246A to the floor as amended with the A2.
All right. Senator Boquist now moves House Bill 2246A to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended by the A2s. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I have a volunteer.
She's the original. I was the original carrier, so.
All right, Senator Dingfelder will retain her status as the carrier on that bill. We'll close the work session on that bill. All right, so this is what we're going to do. First is the intent of the chair that every other bill that's on here that has not been moved out of committee today will be carried over until tomorrow, May 28th. I'm going to go through this list. It may not be exhaustive, but I'm going to go through the ones I believe are going to be carried over, but the intent is to carry over each and every other bill that's on the agenda, which is the revision number one that was issued yesterday. These bills that I believe are the ones being carried over are as follows. House Bill 3295, House Bill 3094A, House Bill 2358, House Bill 2136A, House Bill 2988A, House Bill 2434A, House Bill 2802A, House Bill 2604A, House Bill 2285A, House Bill 2335A, House Bill 2344, House Bill 3271A, House Bill 2727A, House Bill 2238, House Bill 2339A, House Bill 3263, House Bill 2502A, House Bill 2713A, House Bill 2290A, and House Bill 2441A. Again, it's the intent of the chair, if I missed any of the numbers in reciting those, any of the bills that were not moved out of committee today will be carried over until tomorrow, which is Thursday, May 28th. With that, councils, is there anything else that we need to cover?
We will not be meeting today.
We will not be meeting this evening.
Tomorrow we
But tomorrow we are going to do the 8 o'clock, and we'll see if we can get through by then. If not, we may need to come in and finish some work in the early evening. Bill, is there anything else?
No, I'm...
All right, that we're adjourned. Thank you very much for being here.